This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have with us Gray Sophon and Kevin Clemens. Gray is a former clerk of the Futures Committee of Quakers Aotearoa New Zealand. He was educated in physics and worked as a medical physicist in Canada and Australia. He later moved into information technology and undertook to research the management of information systems. On retiring, he became involved in the United Nations Association. Kevin Clements is a former director of the and chair of the Peace and Conflict Studies Center at Otago University and is Secretary General of the International Peace Research Association. And Kevin is now director of the Japanese Todo Peace Institute in Japan, doing global peace and policy research. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz. Well, welcome to Community or Chaos, Gray and Kevin.
Good to be here, Marvin.
Yeah. And Gray's just been with me at the Otago Peace and, the Otago Foreign Policy School, which is talking about the difficulty with the world order and world law. And as Mark Connolly says, it may be fractured. Gray, you've attended the Foreign Policy School 2026, which discussed the world as experiencing fundamental transformation or change more than ever before in human history. What did you hear at the Foreign Policy School that made you think about transformative change?
Well, the school's title was The Faltering International Rules-Based Order in New Zealand, and it was in the context of widespread concern around the world and major international conferences, and most notably in the recent Shangri-La conference dialogue in Singapore. That demonstrated very contrasting world views alongside each other. There's all related to the rise of China and the new US reaction to it, the wars that are going on around particularly in Ukraine and Gaza, and Trump, of course. Then there's also what they call the polycrisis, which links in all this with climate change, artificial intelligence, social media, and a whole host of other challenges. It's really quite a daunting and, one might say, a toxic mix of challenges.
One of the subjects covered at the conference, spoken about, was colonialism and Israel. Israel trying to create a greater Israel through committing genocide against the Palestinians. What is to be done? Kevin, can you talk about this?
Yeah, I think this is one of the major calamities facing the world in the 21st century, which is that Israel, which was forged at the end of the Holocaust and the end of the Second World War, with a lot of promise about a new liberal democracy taking place, is now extremely autocratic, and not only autocratic, but has forgotten the ways in which the Holocaust affected a lot of Jews during the Second World War and after the Second World War. And Israel now has decided that the best way in which it can maintain its independence, defense, security, and so forth, is through a radical process of physical elimination of both Palestinians in Gaza and Hezbollah and related actors in Lebanon, and in its full support for the American bombing of Iran. All of this means that, you know, that Israel is really out of line, you know, with human rights principles. And indeed, there is a Interpol warrant out for Netanyahu's arrest for committing major war crimes.
It may have been that we were too optimistic in the origin of Israel, because people now, a lot of people contend that it was with their relationship with Great Britain and in the Middle East, that it was part of neocolonialism, and that the Palestinians suffered a great deal from their beginning.
No, absolutely. And I mean, the Nakba, of course, was the first major assault on the rights of Palestinians. But now the response to the October 7th massacre of Hamas against Israelis, now we have a situation where 73,000 people and counting were directly killed. Yeah. There are large numbers being killed in a slow genocide in Gaza. You've got the Board for Peace wanting to turn the whole of Gaza into a kind of a sort of a fun resort and is offering voluntary migration to Gazans. I mean, none of this is going to generate peace, and a lot of it is going to generate absolute catastrophe.
As far as the West Bank is also being assaulted, not only by settlers, but by the Israeli government.
Absolutely. And
the killings happening there as well.
That's right. And IDF soldiers and Israeli settlers just feel that they can, that it's open season on Palestinians. And so a major situation where, you know, Israel is actually dictating a lot of the chaos in the Middle East and is reluctant to do anything about it.
Well, what should be done about it, and who?
Well, it's a pity that the United Nations is, so vulnerable and weak at the moment. I mean, the Security Council has resolutions against Israel, but all of them are just ignored and battered away as though they're of no consequence.
It's partly the fault of the five vetoes, isn't it? Because America always vetoes.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also because America continues to supply military weapons to Israel.
Israel couldn't actually do these attacks without the American military aid. They couldn't carry on what they're doing without American military aid.
There were a different, more liberal and progressive regime in power in America that would just cut off the military supplies to Israel. That would be one big first step.
Well, the Democrats didn't.
No, they didn't. Biden, on the other hand, you know, maintain the flow. So there has been a kind of a bipartisan position in America that, you know, Israel can do no wrong and you support it no matter what, whatever. But, I mean, even Trump was beginning to get a little bit weary by the constant Israeli Israeli attacks, which were jeopardizing, you know, the very fragile ceasefire that's managed to be negotiated.
Well, Lebanon is in an unofficial alliance with Iran. So when Lebanon's attacked ferociously and Israeli extends their borders or their soldiers permanent into Lebanon, well, obviously that affects the relationships between America and Iran, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that the Middle East, has to be, there has to be a kind of a global recognition that the Middle East is a major source of conflict and is a major source of the new round of militarization and weapons expenditure that's occurring all around the world. I mean, so, there are a whole number of different things I think that can be done. One is I think that there ought to be a Middle East nuclear weapon-free zone, and that should apply to Israel's nuclear weapons. Secondly, I think that the United Nations should listen, should take heed of the United Nations report on Israel, which shows very clearly that there is genocide taking place and children are being directly targeted by Israeli defense forces. And thirdly, it seems to me that, that the rest of the world has got to kind of begin thinking about sanctions against Israel for the behavior of the past and to prevent calamity in the future.
Okay, thanks a lot for that. Now, why is it important that Russia and America not get away with attacking and invading other countries, other sovereign nations? Not only are they acting unjustly, but it seems to me that they're destroying international law. Can you talk about this, both of you?
Well, absolutely. They're not only they're flaunting international law; they're committing acts of aggression, which are completely unacceptable under international law. It's a major assault on what we used to think of as the rules-based order. There's an enormous unwillingness to kind of bring America under control. I mean, at the moment, you have an appalling situation where the Trump regime has defeated most opposition internally in terms of its actions, engaging in a war of choice which has had terrible consequences. And Russia the same way as its attack on Ukraine. I mean, both of those assaults, I think were a major attack on what was left of the rules-based order. Of course, the rules-based order itself was assaulted by Donald Trump, who withdrew from the World Health Organization, withdrawn from UNESCO, withdrawn from the International Maritime Association, and has not paid its UN dues. So the UN is in a very fragile situation at the moment.
Gray, where do we go from here on that?
Yes, well, we've got to be aware of the sheer importance of the international law. Before the Second World War, international aggression was an accepted practice, and the UN and its charter outlawed that. And to a large extent, that and many other laws have been the basis of New Zealand's stability and security and our prosperity. And that law is starting to break down. And we've got, along with other nations, have got to ensure that that law remains effective. And for that, we've got to support it. We've got to support its abuse or call out its abuse wherever it happens. And certainly Russia and the United States have been major abusers of the law over the last few years.
Well, and in relation to that, the United States administration has decided that power politics is the wave of the future. And that's generating all kinds of pathologies around the world. As as countries forget that power politics led us to the disasters of the 20th century. And so power politics desperately needs to be replaced by collaborative, cooperative, relational politics.
And this is a particular challenge for New Zealand with its close military association with the United States, which it needs because of its weapons and its interoperability with the United States. And it creates a little considerable political dilemma in maintaining our good relations and yet being brave enough to call them out when they do abuse the law.
Well, we've had plenty of chances to do that, Graham. The reality is that the government has always balked at the end. I mean, we were only saved from joining support for the U.S. attack on Iran by Winston Peters saying this wasn't an acceptable policy. We came that close. The current prime minister was, in fact, quite happy to collude with our partners on this. I mean, the reality is that when the rule of law is undermined, then we get naked aggression and coercive capacity become the currency. And that's what we've really got to begin challenging, that dominatory politics will never generate peace. And the new militarization of the world at the moment is really frightening. I mean, for example, on June the 27th, the Finnish government abandoned its long-standing opposition to nuclear weapons and joined the French, the Swedes, and the Norwegians in an extended deterrence agreement with France. So you countries which were neutral are now very much part of a nuclearized and militarized world.
How would you deal with the attack on Ukraine in a way that where they keep their full sovereignty and feel a sense of justice?
Well, this is a big challenge to pacifists and Quakers and others. Marvin and as Gray knows very well. I mean, unfortunately, the kind of the Quaker pacifist position at the moment doesn't have much currency. And so I can't see any real alternative pursuing a kind of a negotiated path, but in a sense, waiting for a kind of a hurting stalemate to bring both Russia and Ukraine to the table. There's absolutely no chance of either side winning this war. So what's necessary is for both sides to acknowledge that there is a hurting stalemate and that they have to get down to the business of negotiation, hopefully supported by the Security Council and others.
One of the challenges here is that the two sides have got very different views of the reality that they're facing, and it requires particularly sophisticated negotiation capabilities. And one of the tragedies of the world is we're putting enormous amount of effort into finding better ways of killing each other, and very little, comparatively little, in developing the skills and facilities that allow us to resolve these tragic conflicts that the world is facing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that sort of any fool can start a fight in a bar or start a war, but not every fool can do conflict resolution, mediation, peacemaking, peace building, which require a different sort of set of skills. I mean, imagination, empathy, and a neutral focus on issues, not actors. And the public sphere in most countries of the world at the moment has become dominated by those who offer only sort of diagnosis, despair, and power political solutions. I mean, so all of the kind of work that we've been doing over the last 20 to 30 years to begin thinking about alternative strategies seems to have been swept under the table as we come back to kind of slugging it out in realpolitik with the, you know, with the most powerful countries dominating the rest.
One of the problems with America is that Trump has gotten rid of most of the diplomats.
Well, he's completely wrecked the State Department, and he's completely abolished USAID, which was America's soft power instrument, and has no desire whatsoever to kind of submit to a multilateral organization that he's not in control of. So the peace board that he's developed, I mean, is a highly partisan instrument which will never bring peace because it's dedicated to kind of ensuring that American power and American positions on political issues prevail.
It's staffed by businessmen and real estate agents, not by diplomats, as far as I can tell.
Right. Witkoff and Jared Kushner are not the people that you would entrust, you know, very delicate negotiations to, and either in relation to Ukraine or the Middle East. I mean, and I think that's one of the big challenges. We have a deficit in political leadership in the US and a lot of people that are quite frankly incompetent to deal with these issues.
If they'd had competent advice, they would have never attacked Iran, because any fool that could look at a map would know what Iran would do with the Strait of Honduras.
Marco Rubio in the Situation Room, when Netanyahu was sitting in the chair's seat in that Situation Room, said it was bullshit to think, quote, it was bullshit to think that this war would achieve any of the goals that Netanyahu and Trump had mapped out. So even in the administration, there was one person who said this was not going to go anywhere. And if you think back to what Trump initially wanted, he wanted regime change, he wanted democratic Iran, he wanted to get rid of the nuclear issue, he wanted to kind of eliminate all of Iran's forces and so forth. And he's had exactly the opposite effect. And any negotiation on nuclear stuff is going to be much less significant than the agreement that was negotiated under the JCPOA.
One of the it's absurd to think in Nashon, the Prime Minister of Israel in the American high security situation room where they plan their future wars and defense.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows you that Netanyahu's managed to sort of wheedle his way into Trump's good books, although Trump will kind of, you know, give him an occasional slap on the wrist, but for jeopardizing the wider peace agreement. But by and large, I think that's a kind of a completely untenable situation in the future. You can't have a small country like Israel dictating terms to the most powerful military and economy in the world.
It's interesting that Trump seems to get on better with people like Netanyahu and Putin than Democrats or people who believe in democracy.
Well, he has an absolute fascination with, hyper-masculine leaders. I mean, autocrats. So Kim Jong-un is, you know, is a favorite of his. Orban, before he was overthrown in Hungary, was a favorite of his. He is just support. He supported the extremely right-wing autocrats in Argentina and now in Colombia. So he's supporting autocrats. And if you want any kind of a metaphor for his regime, you can't get past the cage fight, which he initiated from the grounds of the White House, where you have these guys slugging it out with each other with, in honor of the 250th anniversary of the War of Independence. I mean, that, it just shows you that there is a sort of he has a fascination with hyper-masculinity and powerful men.
Is Trump a symptom? Is Trump the problem or a symptom of a much deeper morass, Gray?
Both, I think. Certainly, there's bases in U.S. history which Trump is exploiting or working from, particularly the superiority of American of America in the world. Make America great again, and but he's put in a distinctive role on it, and made it a particularly personal campaign and personal approach in seeing his view as the key issue, and personalizing a lot of the things like the tariff processes, so you've got to be personally supporting Trump to get his favors. So yeah, it's both symptom and cause in many respects.
Trump doesn't believe in the better angels of our nature. He believes in pandering to kind of fear and anxiety, and he arouses fear and anxiety around immigrants, and around diversity, around equality, and around inclusion. I mean, he's made all three of those policies kind of central to his political program. And that's having ripples all around the world, even here in New Zealand. I mean, the ACT Party, for example, is following his playbook. It's very down on migrants.
One of the things about Trump is that he has, like many very wealthy people, who has a very high sense of entitlement. I doubt if he's ever been held accountable from the time he was born for anything he did.
I think that's true.
Not only has he
a high sense of entitlement, but he's done everything in his path to make sure that there is no account, that he has no responsibility and no accountability for his actions. So if you look at what he just negotiated with the Inland Revenue Department, the Inland Revenue Department, under his cronies, have given him a tax-free status for the rest of his life.
But America's watched Trump for 8 years. The first time he got elected, you could see it. But they watched him lie. They watched him try to overthrow the government in January 06. In the election he lost, and money in America, money you go to give to politicians and political parties is not even transparent. The Supreme Court decided the money you give to politicians and political parties is freedom of speech, which the government has no say-so in at all, no responsibility. The America's become more unequal in this century than it's ever been before.
Well, that's the neoliberalism, I think, is at the heart of what we're talking about.
This is why I'd say that Trump is more of a symptom than the main problem.
You're
likely to get somebody like Trump, and you're likely to lose democracy when you have thus much inequality and the people and the billionaires have so much power.
But I mean, that's what we're talking about, Marvin. That's the underlying driver of all of this is neoliberalism with its kind of, make the wealthy people even wealthier.
But also the sense of power that goes with it.
Sense of power that goes with wealth.
And I think that's one thing we don't have anybody like Trump, hopefully, in New Zealand, but that's one of the things we have to worry about is the growing inequality. Because immense inequality and democracy don't go well together, do they?
No.
I think we have impact of Trump's influence, and particularly the funding of the various political parties demonstrate an enormous impact of wealth on the political process, and we need to be.
Is that true in New Zealand?
It's true in New Zealand, yes, indeed.
Well, if you look at the National Party, for example, at this stage, the National Party has got something like five times the amount of money that Labour has.
And ACT has more.
Yeah.
And you wonder about policy like tobacco taxes and so on. But that's another question. Some of the questions that came up at the conference were climate change, strategic resilience, pandemics such as COVID, the threat of nuclear war, global overshoot, and climate change and environmental crisis, which material growth makes results from material growth, actually, when there's no limit to it. And the possibility or probability of worldwide recession or depression. And you've got AI and its the power it gives to the people that own it and use it. These are all, how do we deal with these issues? And can you deal with them one nation at a time?
We've got to recognize that it goes far beyond what those you mentioned. There's just a whole host of social, economic, environmental. I mean, climate change is only one of the major environment boundaries, what they call the planetary boundaries, which we've got to concern ourselves with. And so there's a lot of other factors that on the environmental level, as well as the social impact of AI. We've got the enormous influence of wealth within the in combined with technologies, which pervade our society. We've got concerns about energy, food. We've got evolving technologies of all sorts, technical, electronic, as well as biological technologies, each with its challenge. I've got the list of well over 20 items. And it's just so overwhelming for people to try and get an appreciation with the best of intentions. It's a mind-boggling challenge for the world. We're just not used to such a complex of issues. And the dire need, people increasingly are talking about the absolute need of cooperation between nations to actually work through these issues and address many of them global dimensions. And we just don't have that experience and capabilities of international cooperation that we need to make any sense to make any chance of resolving many of these really challenging and threatening issues.
But the reality is, Gray, that we're not going to deal with any of these things at a national level alone, because the poly crisis is a global crisis, and as you said, it's multidimensional. And the big question that I think we have to face is, you know, if at the moment the kind of legal architecture for multilateralism around the United Nations is vulnerable, you know, then it seems to me that we should be directing more attention to kind of begin thinking of regional solutions that we can kind of, you know, put in place on an incremental basis, and then utilize those to kind of, you know, think about ways in which they might be also added to by a revived and reimagined United Nations. But the reality is that none of the issues you put on the table are capable of being solved at a national level alone. So they have to force a kind of a regional multilateralism and a global multilateralism. And that, I think, is a kind of big challenge right now, which is, and I think that in order to break it down, I think, you know, it's really important that, you know, New Zealand works with ASEAN, works with Northeast Asia, and works with China and so forth, to begin thinking about, you know, a kind of a collaborative problem-solving approach to these issues, rather and kind of sequence them in terms of, you know, imminence and lethality.
And a major factor here, I believe, is a very difficult one, and I use the term militarism, which is the belief that a military provides a vital role in preserving security. It's an issue which has been with us for a very long time, historically, but it's becoming more and more vital as the destructiveness of military techniques is increasing, and the sophistication of them is continuing to increase. And on a national level, it makes a lot of sense to have an effective military, considering the state that the world is in. But when you look at it from a global perspective, it's just sheer insanity that we would expect to solve all the difficult problems by shooting and killing each other. And it's just a solution for global disintegration. And somehow we've got to work from our national desires to have a security to a global perspective in which we're are working together cooperatively.
Doesn't New Zealand, in some ways, have an opportunity with our nuclear-free policy and, until recently, our independent foreign policy to provide a different perspective in our region, particularly with the Pacific Island nations?
Well, ideally, we ought to be able to do that, Marvin, but the reality is that at the moment, there are so many regional forces at work and regional dynamics at work that make it very difficult for us to kind of express our own, you know, nuclear-free, independent, neutral position on things. So our relationship with Australia is tight, and it's also kind of heavily militarized. The reality is that if nations keep on moving towards what Trump would like them to be, that is 5% of our GDP, that will cut into a whole bunch of kind of social welfare, education, and health provisions. and it won't deliver any extra security. And on the contrary, when you have a large numbers of allies gathered together, for example, as we do in Europe, each trying to move towards 5% of their GDPs to go towards the military, and that'll create a security dilemma in China and in Russia and elsewhere.
Well, this would be bad for New Zealand. I mean, if we have a very tight, strong military alliance with the United States, doesn't that actually take away our independence and our ability to push for a better world? To actually communicate with other nations.
But Marvin, look at what's happening here at the moment. I mean, we don't have a kind of a formal relationship with the US, but Luxon and Albanese in Australia are very keen that we kind of collaborate and integrate most of our military assets and so forth.
Wouldn't that be a mistake for New Zealand?
Well, it is a mistake for New Zealand, but I'm saying that it's a mistake which is kind of is remorseless at the moment. I mean, take Rocket Lab, for example. You know, that's now, you know, engaged in very heavy militarization of space and search and kill kind of processes in relation to missiles.
Should have to make a choice. Are they going to be a New Zealand company and corporation or an American one?
They've just taken over an American company, and they're now one of the biggest low-level rocket manufacturers in the world.
But is this the way we want our economy to go?
No, absolutely. I don't want our economy to go there. I want all of the ingenuity of Rocket Lab going into kind of developing.
We have a choice. We are still a democracy. We have a choice. We could have our political parties could make different choices.
They could and they should. But, you know, the reality is that foreign policy is kind of treated as a bit of a sacred cow. MFAT determines, the limits of possibility. And, you know, we can kind of do things at the margins. But, you know, in the end, we end up finding ourselves in close kind of military relationship with our closest ally, Australia, and with the United States as well.
I would suggest there's more to it than that. That the our military, the increasing awareness that our links to the United States are not to our advantage, and if the clear understanding that our independence is valuable to us. The United States is actually, our association with the United States is actually threatening us. At the same time, we have extensive relationships and we've got a long-term record of, and beneficial record of relationships with a wide range of countries around the world. Focus on that, those relationships and the enhancement of those relationships to promote our trade and our negotiations, our understanding intelligence, our ability to understand just what is happening around the world, and recognition of our positive contribution to genuine security of our region. And people in our region are increasingly looking for that process of cooperation that New Zealand can contribute to.
Yeah, that's why we're focusing most of our attention on the Pacific and Asia. I mean, I think the balance probably should be tilted a little bit more in the Asian direction than the Pacific. But I think that becomes a sort of a substratum of everything else.
does the UN need reform itself?
The UN needs to be completely reinvented. There have been all kinds of efforts to reform the United Nations, but until there is a kind of a willingness to really begin rethinking, you know, United Nations for the 21st century, I think, you know, it'll keep spluttering along. It's really important that we kind of, you know, begin almost like a sort of a blank page, you know, which doesn't kind of give so much power to the P5, and which also gives more kind of diplomatic capacity to the United Nations and the Security Council. So I don't think, you know, there are plenty of, in terms of its 80th anniversary, there were plenty of ideas of how to reform the United Nations, but none of them really grappled with that issue about the P5.
One of the things that was talked about at the foreign policy school is there's a huge number of countries in the United Nations, and they're all part of the General Assembly of the United Nations. They might, do you think, should they push for the idea that if two-thirds of them vote for a resolution, that should be able to overcome the veto?
Yeah, that would be a good idea. That's one way of dealing with it. But I think that the reality is that, you know, the veto power at the moment means that all of the P5 can behave absolutely recklessly and without any kind of real thought for.
But the only people who can change that are the countries that are part of the UN,
yeah,
including the small states and middle states. Yeah, I mean, one of the arguments for in support of John Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, is that small nations and middle nations should work together.
I think that's a wonderful beginning point, which sort of connects back to what I was saying in terms of regionalism. You know, how do we kind of, you know, make sure that our relationships with like-minded and similar-sized countries is robust and energizing for everybody?
A interesting and perhaps influential possibility here comes from a unsuspected direction, and there's a major country which has developed a series of very promising proposals called the Global Initiatives that have been widely ignored. The country it comes from is China, and yeah, unfortunately the amount of negative information we get from about China makes people very wary of these proposals, and maybe there's some justification to that, but nevertheless, they are very constructive. They're very much based on the United Nations and the reform of the United Nations. And of cooperation and mutual support of countries, respect for countries' sovereignty, and a lot of very constructive aspects of it. And this is an area that we need to pay more attention and ensure that we make the best of it. Whatever that is, we need to go at it with eyes open and in cooperation with all those that are interested, which are a major number from the Global South, but also a significant number of developed countries.
Yeah, I agree with that, Gray. I think that, you know, we really got, I mean, China is the one of the few members of the P5 that are really kind of committed to, a new, possibly a new, but a rules-based order. And I think that, it's really important that, they be given, maximum support by New Zealand and other like-minded countries. We do need to kind of, be aware of the fact that, China itself is a big power and an expanding power, and hopefully won't succumb to, big power delusions of grandeur or anything. But I agree with you. I think that it's important that we kind of look at all of their proposals for a kind of more collaborative, more cooperative, more empathetic world. I think that's a very, very sensible thing to do.
For a long period after World War II, it has it, there was always a certain amount of hypocrisy and failure, but there was also a much more willingness for collective action, and especially with the creation of the United Nations. Included this collective action included trying to solve world problems such as world hunger, underdevelopment, and preventing large-scale wars. What's happened to our collective resolve? Gray, can you talk about that?
Well, the devastation of the Second World War generated a desperation. I did a study actually on the role of the Rotary organization or Rotary Club in the on the development of the United Nations. And all through the war, the Rotary organizations put a lot of effort into sorting out what is the future world we want to live in. And that forced a broader thinking, much more inclusive thinking, that led, which affected people's attitudes to the world and to national interests. And this broad perspective was an important theme within the development of the United Nations, and affected much of the wide range of organizations. The United Nations is actually composed of over 100 different organizations doing all sorts of things like the oceans and trade and health and so that whole range of vital functions, particularly for developing countries, but as we see it for at COVID, it was vital for all nations. But since then, people have been coming more national focused, and even New Zealand's foreign affairs discussions are very largely about our national interests, and there's very little effort, I find, among nations in general about looking at collective interests. Now, climate change is one example of something that clearly forces a global perspective, but too much that is being narrowed to particular nations' interest in that. And so we've got this great conflict between the narrow national thinking and the global necessities. It happens in a national level. We get the focus of particular interest groups, and with that, not coping with the need of the nation too. So it's a human characteristic to focus down on what you can understand and what you can manage. But we need people who can manage the globe. We need people who can think broadly. And those sorts of skills need to be developed.
There are two other things that need to be said about that, Gray. One is that
2 minutes.
Prior to the development of the United Nations, I mean, there were very active civil society organizations like the Rotary and others that were kind of really promoting multilateralism all around the world as a way of preventing the Second World War occurring again. And the second is that there was a kind of an extraordinarily powerful sense of humanitarian impulse, which was kind of, you know, a response to the catastrophe of the Second World War. And that humanitarian, that basic desire for humanitarianism, I think, is a bit of a premium at the moment. That we don't think in terms of, you know, our common humanity. And I think that's one of the issues that really needs to be put on the table again, you know, that so that we can rediscover that notion that, you know. Okay.
Thank you both for coming on board and for your for your vision for a better future and the problems we face. We've been talking with Kevin Clements and Gray Southern about international issues.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.